Welcome to another great episode of the Pluralcast. I'm your host, David Starr, and today we get to sit down and talk with Scott Seeley, who's doing some amazing things with distributed systems. Well, I certainly had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and for all of you American listeners, I hope you did too. But that brings me in line with Christmas, right? Now we have to start thinking about that. And I gotta tell you, I've never been a big gamer. I've never been someone who even owned a console, never owned a gaming console. But the other day, I was walking around the store and I happened to walk in front of a Xbox with a Kinect installed on it. And one thing led to another. That's what my kids are getting for Christmas. Well, they are, right? Not me. It's not for me, you understand. It's for my kids. So, just thought I'd throw that out there. This whole Kinect thing, pretty awesome. And, that's right, it's hackable via Linux. So, maybe more on that another time. But for now, let's talk about Scott Seeley, who's the president of, and I hope I pronounced this right, Frizzeton LLC. He is a Microsoft Regional Director. And for a long time, actually 4 years from 2002 to 2006, he was a developer on the WCF Indigo team at Microsoft, and that definitely means this guy's got some services chops. Well, now he is actually making content with Pluralsight and contributing to Pluralsight On Demand, and also out there teaching classes on WCF and distributed systems. But in this discussion, Scott was able to sit down and talk with me about some of the architectural pillars and concerns that we have when we look at distributed systems. Scott's the recent author of .NET Distributed Systems Architecture and WCF for Architects, two Pluralsight On Demand courses. And when I looked at the outlines for these courses and sort of read through the contents, I saw that he was paying attention to things like patterns of enterprise architecture within these courses. And I just thought, wow, I really need to get this guy on the show. He has a lot to teach us. So with no further ado, welcome, Scott Seeley.
I've been doing distributed systems for about 18 years now. My first one, I think, was the Boeing 777.
Oh, really? You were on that?
So I was on the validation verification team. I was only 22 or 23 at the time. So I did. I was a tester, and I've read the entire autopilot more times than I care to admit.
That's awesome.
But that even that system, though, that was a huge distributed system. They had three computers that voted. Two Intel 386s and one Motorola chip. I think it was a 68040.
What do you mean they voted?
Autopilot flies by sensors, right? So each of the computers had a feed from the sensors into their own detectors. And what they would do, and they were all running the exact same program, and they would vote on what they should do next. Should I go up? Should I go down? Should I turn left? Should I turn right? Okay? And they'd also vote on how high do you think we are right now? So at any time that they need to read from the sensors, they would vote.
Huh.
And if they had two out of three the same, then that was the reading they used. And that was to make sure that the thing was very stable.
And in the event where you have three that disagree?
In the event that you have three that disagree, you do the reading, I think, twice more, and if they still disagree, you warn the pilot.
Wow.
And so that he, you know, because by and large, with that particular autopilot, the pilot was responsible for getting to the end of the runway, and then there's a button on there that's called takeoff go around, or the toga switch. They press takeoff go around, and they can literally kick back and go to sleep until they get to the airport, to the next airport, and then they only have to be awake from when the plane hits the ground till they get to the gate.
You know, this isn't engendering a lot of confidence, but...
Yeah, so those robot drivers that you've heard about from MIT, they've been in the skies for the last 20 years.
Maybe there's more room for error up there.
Actually, there's less room for error.
Well, there's more space.
Yeah, but, so they're also able to communicate and figure out if there's an airplane nearby. But yeah, so they give each other, you know, they give everybody plenty of berth, you know, plenty of room. It's really an amazing thing. They're able to feed into the whole network so they can figure out where the different airplanes are so they can alter their routes and so on. But it's primarily they got like global information about, you know, where the weather patterns are, where's the jet stream at, which, you know, should they fly at 30,000 feet or 35,000 feet to take advantage of the greatest tailwind?
Oh, sure, sure. Cool.
So, yeah, they've got, and the pilot really doesn't do much.
I'm sure that all the pilots that listen to the Pluralcast, and I know there are thousands, would take umbrage with that. But
yeah. No, so I've been doing distributed systems for a long time, so I'm highly opinionated on lots of things that about distributed systems and how you build them.
So I tell you what, let's do. Let's just talk about some of those things that you mentioned that you need as sort of infrastructure for building that reliable and well-designed distributed application. So what are they?
Okay, so some of the things that you need. So when you're building a big distributed application, things that you need is you need to be able to have some sort of configuration management is always important, so you can figure out where your parts are distributed and where they're at. A very important bit, which some people like to put up to the last minute or until they get their first set of bugs, is logging. Typically with the logging, what you want to do is you want to be able to capture logs locally at each of the machines, but you also want some sort of central repository where you can analyze those logs and figure out what happened when something bad went off. As a corollary to that logging, then you also want monitoring to let you know that you should look at the logs right now. So, you know, you had another piece. And the monitoring bit is something that you want to be able to have hooked up to your administrative people so that your administrators will get, you know, an SMS message, they'll get an email, or they'll have some sort of an alert pop up on like the a SCOM, you know, Microsoft System Center Operations Manager, or the Microsoft Operations Manager, or whatever infrastructure tool they're using for doing monitoring to say, hey, something's going bad right now.
I see. So I was expecting you to say, oh, well, you need these sorts of products. But what you're effectively saying is that you need a good infrastructure to support all those cross-cutting concerns that we're going to need.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's as far as, like, you know, there's a lot of products out there that support things, you know, like BizTalk supports being able to connect many systems together and do the EDI transformations. But that's what you find that's really – what you really need to do is once you get the system up and running, the most important thing you need to have built in there is the ability to find out what went wrong. If you can't figure out what went wrong, you wind up having problems launching. And once you're in production, you have problems keeping your customers satisfied. So if you don't have, and you have to nail that right away so that when something goes wrong, you can fix it as fast as possible. And the reason to get it in early is so that your development team understands how this stuff works so that they'll be using these tools from day one to troubleshoot the application. So, you know, you build up like these production environment, and you want to do all your testing in the production, and you're going to have bugs as you're doing your testing. So you want to figure out what it was. And if you don't have these standardized tools in place right away, you don't build up that tribal knowledge of how these things work. And then you wind up having to put them in production, and you cross your fingers and hope they work, which is never a good situation.
Well, one of the things that you just glanced over really quickly, but I know from experience has just got all kinds of snakes in this pit, is versioning of services. And I'm wondering if you have a standard way that you like to do that, because I know that a lot of folks struggle with it.
Also, versioning of services, actually, that's one of the fun things and one of my minor claims to fame is that I wrote, actually, I think the first Microsoft position paper on how you do versioning of services. And I wound up doing it just as a thing about, we were doing this thing called pencilsellers.org, trying to explain how would you version a pencil selling service, and wrote this paper up, and IBM came yelling back at someone up high up in Microsoft saying, why did you do this? And I wound up getting to meet a lot of very powerful people at Microsoft that day.
Really? Why is that?
It wound up being good for my career because I wound up being able to explain what I thought was going on. They were able to explain why it was an issue. Got to set up all the relationships that I needed in order to make sure that whenever I put out something that was this, you know, that would get this type of attention, that at least they were aware of it so they could handle it, you know. So we'd have to make sure that the folks who would get contacted when Scott said something weird would know that Scott said it ahead of time. And as a result, I got to develop a lot of really good relationships. I think that's a good chunk of the reason why the WCF team even let me on the team to begin with. So anyhow, but with versioning, so there's a lot of ways that you handle versioning. There's a couple things to keep in mind. There's harmless things that you can do to a version where if you change, so there's a set of things you can change, and when you change those things, you don't do any harm to existing clients. And then there are the things that you change in a new version that break existing clients. So the what I like to do is I like to say, here's how you analyze these things. And in there's a general rule that you can follow where you'll never screw up. And then if you want to walk the dangerous path, I've got recommendations on that too. And you'll wind up walking the dangerous path when you're doing things like agile development and you don't actually ship to customers and you don't want a version just because you finished another sprint. So looking down that path, the things that you can do that are harmless are if I add new functions that didn't exist before, that's usually harmless because existing clients, they don't know about them, they don't call them. And if I don't change the behavior of the application, don't require those, if it's a REST application or REST service, those getters, setters, putters, whatever, nothing bad happens then. If I do something with a SOAP-based service, and again, if those aren't required parts of the operation for successful interaction with the service, no harm happens. And in those cases, you can technically leave everything as is and you won't break anybody. Then there's a case where you do break people, and that's where you rename parameters, rename messages that go back and forth, or make certain things required for startup, or you make things all of a sudden become terminating actions. Whenever you change the fundamental contract and say things, so if you want to summarize that, then it would be any time that you have a service and that service changes the promises it made to the clients, you break clients. I'm not changing promises when I add new promises, but I am changing promises when I remove them.
And so do you just, I guess in a simple way, if my regression tests all pass that go against that service endpoint, then I haven't really broken anything. But if I make one of those tests turn red, probably need to version something.
Yes, and exactly. So that would be a great point, great way to look at it is if you all of a sudden you have a red ball in your tests, at that point what that tells you is you need to create a new endpoint that hosts your new version. And then you can do things like one of the recommendations I have is take the so one of the issues that you run into with versioning is that you want to be able to support old clients and the new ones. You want to be able to innovate on your service, but you also want to be able to support the people who are currently using it. So you got to do a couple things. One is you have to develop some sort of a service level agreement with the existing clients and promise them that what from the date that they adopt something until it's dead will live for a certain time period. And that time period depends on your organization and who your clients are. So sometimes you'll see that last for 6 months. Sometimes you'll see it for 2 years. And I've worked with some organizations where they wanted it to last for 2 years, but they're now in the 11-year mark.
Right, right. Sort of like using Visual Source Safe.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, but you have to support your clients. So what you want to do then is you create you use the facade pattern. And what you'll do is you'll make sure that as you version things, you want to make sure that your regression tests continue to pass against the old interface. And then any new functionality you want, you can essentially copy and paste. So you clone the old interface, give it a new URL and a new XML namespace if you're using XML type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case there, you just add the new functionality. And ideally, you redirect the old to the new. If you add new parameters, have sensible defaults. If you add new functions, well, you don't need to call them. If you remove functions from the interface, you need to have some sort of a proxy that works and allows the old functionality to work. So it only works in regression scenarios, I guess. That is, if you have some functionality you don't want to expose to everybody, but you want to continue supporting the old clients, that would be, I guess, that case.
So if I got that right, you're saying, so let's say we're going to release version 2 of all of our services. When we do that, our version 1 implementations will be in effect rewritten to use a facade that then invokes the operations from version 2. Is that what you're saying?
Ideally, that's what you want to be able to do because you're going to fix bugs, you're going to create new things, and so long as you can maintain the data contract in between the client and the service, you're doing no harm. Yeah.
Okay. So that way we're not forking out all these different versions of functionality that have their own cost associated with them.
Right. Now, the downside to this is that you'll see a lot of folks who are at WCF services put an awful lot of business logic inside the service. So what I've had is I've had to re-educate folks and tell them WCF layer is nothing more than the user interface for machines. So like when you do an HTML layer, you're presenting a user interface for people, and it's got data they can understand. And ideally what we do is we have a very thin UI layer that has a heavy controller that and everything else that worries about things, but our views should be very simple and only worry about presentation. WCF layer should be the exact same thing. It's the presentation layer for machines.
It's a nice way of thinking of that. Cool. It's sort of the view.
Yep. And I'm pretty sure that the architecture class that I have online actually goes through that and shows that the WCF layer is just another view.
You're talking about the .NET Distributed Systems Architecture course in the Pluralsight library? Cool. Another thing that you bring out in there is that there are some repeatable patterns that people use in these distributed systems, and you've already mentioned one facade. It makes perfect sense exactly why that's so effective in the situation you brought up. What are some others?
Oh, gosh. So other patterns. So by and large, the gang of four patterns don't wind up appearing in distributed systems. So some of the patterns you're going to see then in these larger distributed applications wind up being things to make sure that you're monitoring the application correctly, that you're watching your inputs and outputs. As a matter of fact, so if you want to get back to like the service implementations, part of that facade is going to wind up being something that uses what's called a validation pattern. You want to measure all of your input and make sure that it's correct. Measure, look at, inspect. The reason why you want to do this, and again, it's one of those things that gets people when they first move over to distributed programming, is because when you build applications using C# or compiled language, what happens is the compiler does an awful lot of nice things for you. One of the nicest things it does for you is that if you have a signature that says you must pass in a employee type, the compiler will make sure that an employee shows up each and every time. When you go into distributed architectures, you're typically talking about systems that are implemented using heterogeneous languages, heterogeneous technologies. And the other thing, too, is that the input that's coming in is typically text-based. As a result, when the other person compiles their application and then chooses to send you an employee, their employee may really be a completely different object with a completely different representation. And so you have to inspect what comes in. The other thing is that some of the values on the employee may be certain types of values. For example, you might have an enumeration that indicates whether or not the employee is a male or a female. The person who sends you that message could put in boxcar, they could put in dog or house into that value, and it would break. So one of the patterns that you wind up seeing in distributed applications is input validation. You look over everything and make sure that everything is correct. If anything's not right, you then have to decide what you do. Do you tell the user, hey, I expected male or female, you sent me house? Or do you just ignore their error and call it a null? So that's another one of the patterns you see in these.
Does it make sense in that world to inspect at a very raw message level and just check that our message is assembled properly that it has all the data we need, right? And that it's in the format we expect. But then I have maybe another little class that's probably going to do my assembly. And let's say it's that employee that came over. It's a DTO of that employee that came over the wire. I do my input validation on the DTO. Yep, that's good. Now I pass it off to an assembler of some sort. That assembler is going to hand back to me the employee object that I want and that I can work with. Is that sort of a natural chain of events?
So you're talking about going from the DTO to the business object, essentially.
Right.
And there's some sort of an intermediary that grabs, that says, oh, you got this DTO. Well, that's really this business object with all this other functionality.
Right.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. As a matter of fact, that's another thing that's frequently done, and that's how you usually maintain the version. That's how you handle the versioning problem a lot of times, is you have a certain version of the data coming in, and then what you do is you hand it off to a factory object or something else that says, given a person, a V1 person, I'm going to yield you a business object of type person of the current version, and then you get to go do all your work on that.
That makes really good sense. So I might have a factory, and if I version up my services, I may have a new input method, overload, perhaps, where I'm going to take a different version of a DTO, version 1, version 2, and I'll give you back that same person every time. But yeah, that makes perfect sense. Cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, polymorphism to the rescue. Actually, that's inheritance to the rescue, I guess, but yeah.
Okay, so I'm sorry to interrupt. You were talking about output validation, actually.
No problem. I like going on these little sides. So then there's output validation as well. And with output validation, what you want to make sure is not that your value that you're returning is correct. You should have something built into your testing environment and everything else that makes sure that the DTOs you return are always correct. But with output validation, what you really want to do is you want to make sure that the information you're sending back to the caller doesn't leak information about your system that you don't want the caller to know about. In particular, so a lot of times what you'll do is you'll have a request come in for a particular for some data. Part of the input validation might be making sure that the current caller is allowed to see the data they're requesting. On output data, what you want to make sure of is that should the request that they sent in generate any internal exceptions, any internal logging, or any other interesting errors that might indicate the infrastructure of your system, you want to send back to them not the exception, but typically a message indicating something bad happened. And then here's an ID that you can use to when you call up support and say, I just got, a bad thing happened, log ID number 14. Can you please tell me how to fix things? And then the other side can go look at in their logging system and say, ID number 14 that indicates that we had, some other work has to happen on your account, whatever that might be. And the good thing about that, again, is that it doesn't reveal the infrastructure of your application, which means that it doesn't allow others to attack your app.
Okay. And that sounds like a more rigorous way of ensuring that than what I probably would have done had I been given that problem today, which is to simply just be really careful about what I serialize out, right? That's going one step further.
Yeah. And the nice thing is that in the messaging-based systems like WebCF, there's actually this thing called an iError handler. And so the way you implement this pattern is you say that I want to capture all errors that come through that weren't handled by anybody else. And then when the error comes through, what you can do is you can actually log the exception someplace to a central store. You can return the ID for the log, and then you tell the person just a very nicely formatted message that says, bad thing happened on the server, so it's a server fault. The ID of the fault is, like I said before, 14. Please call 555-1212, ask for Sam, and he'll help you figure things out.
Okay.
You can go as detailed as you want to. The other interesting thing you can do with these as well is with these types of errors is you can also watch for things like maintenance windows. For example, if someone sends a database request, a request that caused a database to be hit and you're doing maintenance like a database upgrade, you can even send back messages that say, please retry this message in 3 hours when we expect to be done with maintenance. So you can do lots of interesting things with these types of systems to help stuff work. And because the messages you send back can be interpreted by machines, you can again make them continue to work right. And these are those little things that you have to think about when you're building distributed apps that you don't have to think about when you're building single user apps, like a mobile application, for example.
It's interesting too, though, is that some of those I'll call them non-happy path return messages that you're providing there. Where system downtime is a perfect example. We have to make sure that our clients are actually coding for those conditions, right?
Oh gosh, yeah. Companies that I've worked for where we do actually send those, the system downtime stuff is typically I try to write SDKs for the clients. So I did a short stint over at MySpace, and one of the things we did at MySpace was we wrote clients for Ruby, PHP, Java, C#, a couple others, I think. So what you usually do when you're building APIs around the services is you give the user an SDK that they can use. With that SDK, so the SDK is a set of classes they can include into their projects to make things work. The other thing you include then is you include sample code. The sample code has to include code that shows what happens when the happy path doesn't get executed. So if an exception happens, you have to, and you handle the exception. You can't do the sample code that you might do in a demonstration in front of an audience. You actually have to give them the sample code that shows handling all the error cases. If you do that, you usually wind up with fairly pleased clients.
So is the expectation in that, let's just keep working on that system downtime scenario, because it's really real and very interesting. Is your expectation in that world that the client is going to be buffering up their messages for later and they're going to come back in and run through all the requests that they weren't able to make?
So, yeah, typically what we expect is that the client will buffer those things up. Now, the types of things that a client will be using during an accepted maintenance window are typically things like synchronization tasks. These aren't heavy user interactivities type things. And The real reason, if it's a synchronization task, typically what will happen is the service that's running in the background will just read the message and then not do anything for a while. It'll just reschedule itself to run in 4 hours or whenever you said you'll be ready. Now, if it's a live system, it says it's going to be not available for 3 hours. And let's say it's a user interface type thing that you actually want to show people. Then what you do is you wind up in what you call a state of reduced functionality. And then what will happen is you expect that the system will be able to display a message that says, I'm sorry, the functionality that you're trying to access now will not be available until, say, 2 p.m. or depending, you know, whatever the time might be on your clock, on the local client's clock. Just to let them know that, you know, the system's still up and running, but that particular aspect can't be accessed. In that case, you're not backing up anything. You're just not executing anything at all. As far as queuing up requests, then the other option, of course, is if you're running a queue-based system where things aren't being processed and you know that you're going to have maintenance windows, ideally what you want to do is you want to have some sort of a service where you can dump the message, and then whenever the service is right, the processor is ready to pick things up, you just pick the stuff up again. So in those cases, if you need to be able to submit lots and lots of work, you don't want to design for an interactive system.
Right, right. Okay, so in that model, you want to have a set of messages or set of, really an architecture that's almost a fire and forget, and I'll come back and get my results later.
Exactly. The other thing you also want to be able to do is you want to be able to check and see the status of the things that you've already submitted and see whether or not they're being processed on or they're still in the queue.
Because there may be a big workflow or something associated with those.
Exactly. And in some cases, it might be along the lines of the ID. So you might submit a work request, and let's say you're using GWIDS because you know that odds are really good that you won't have any duplicates. So you can then say, I want to get the status of the job number, you know, with a particular GWID, and it says, I don't have that one in my system yet, so you know it's still in queued. And then you have to build in also things for retry logic. So if it doesn't show up in the queue within X number of hours, what do you do? But again, that all falls back on, you have to have a service level agreement which states how fast should things be processed, and if they're not processed that fast, what do you do next?
So here's a question that I'm really curious about, and it's going to date me. It's going to tell you how old I am, I think. but I feel pretty good because I bet you're this old too.
I bet I am.
So I remember Don Box and Aaron Sconard standing up there maybe 10 or more years ago when we were first talking about SOAP, and they were talking about UDDI. And UDDI at the time was going to be this wonderful world of being able to seamlessly compose and auto-discover services, and things would just wire up auto-magically. And I'm wondering, is there any technology that's a discovery mechanism that really has caught, and how is it used? Where did that whole idea go?
Okay, so UDDI is one of those things. Good friends with one of the guys who wrote the first UDDI implementation way back when. And one of the things he told me is that the reason why UDDI wound up failing in the global market is because they implemented the UDDI yellow pages, which was, you know, some sort of a market for buying and selling services, and that's not what it was meant to be. It was meant to be a service discovery mechanism. As a service discovery mechanism, UDDI is still alive and kicking in enterprise America, and it's being primarily used so that people can move, you know, if you start getting to the point where you need to make your services agile, you need to move them from point to point, or if you have a global network, and you want to have an instance for North America, an instance for South America, an instance for, you know, someplace in EMEA. All those types of things still work pretty well with UDDI, and so you'll see it shipping with BizTalk. However, as far as discoverability goes, and the more common cases, you know, the more utopian pieces that we were being sold, that actually wound up going, and now there's a spec that was released recently called WS Discovery, or actually it was released a while ago. It was finally implemented on the Microsoft stack in .NET 4. And WS Discovery actually has some pretty neat mechanisms. So for discoverability, which is yet another enterprise pattern that you might want to implement, so you have a lot of options. And if you want to do automated discovery, WS Discovery allows you to do ad hoc discovery where all the nodes are in the same subnet, they can find each other. And you can also do managed discovery, and that's if all the nodes are reachable via the network. You know, if node A can find the managed endpoint and can find the endpoint that's being advertised, you can have things work that way as well. And that'll handle over subnets and over the internet. But that's, you know, again, discoverability is yet another pattern for enterprise architectures, and discoverability winds up taking a number of forms. So there's machine discovery, There is human discovery, which is in a lot of cases more important than the machine discovery, and also one of the things where I think people don't really understand what they need to do. If we wanted to go down that path a little bit, then the human-based discovery. So first up, did I answer your question?
I think so. What's going on in my mind right now is I'm wondering why. I'm wondering what is the driving scenario for using these types of things.
Oh, okay. So the driving scenario for using these types of things, if you have a few machines all sitting in the same data center, probably on the same rack, they're all going to be on the same subnet. And what you might want to do is you might want to be able to allow these things to discover each other automatically. The driving force behind this is that you don't want to have to go into your configuration file and say that in test, we're on one subnet. So what you'll probably have is in your test environment, you're on one subnet. When you're in dev, you're on another subnet. When you're in production, you're on a third subnet. And you do this simply because the number of computers that you have available to you is finite. So the number of addresses you have available to you is also constrained. And what you'll want to be able to do is you'll want to be able to have these clients and these services find each other automatically. This reduces configuration headaches. And actually, that's the primary reason to do this is remembering that in test, I'm using test 03, test 04, and test 17. But in production, I'm using Hamlet, Macbeth, and pick another play by Shakespeare. So I'm using those machines. Having to remember how those all exist and then making sure you have the right web configs and you have all the right merge scripts and build scripts and deployment scripts, it's just one more headache. And if you know how they're going to be deployed, which would be in the same subnet on the same rack, then what you can do is you can allow these services to find each other so that your back-end service and your front-end services can just, the client can say, I want to find an implementation of the iFoo service. And then the iFoo service says, so where are you? It finds that information, caches it, and uses that information whenever it needs to talk to iFoo ever again.
Okay, that helps me so much because for so long, and I think I've been carrying this now for a couple of years, I had this misconception that the idea of discovery was about being able to programmatically look at, here's a service, what do you do?
And so that's UDDI, right?
Pardon?
That's UDDI.
Right. And I never could figure out really why I would use this, but the types of discovery mechanism you're talking about where I know that I want the foo service, just, hey, somebody out there, you're a foo service, let me talk to you. That makes every bit of sense.
Yeah. And the things that you'll do then is when you're talking to a service and you're using discovery, the other interesting scenarios where you'll use it or other constraints in that scenario are typically you also know what type of security is going to be used. Typically, when you try to talk to the iFoo service, you're going to be on the same corporate network. And this is whether you're doing managed discovery or ad hoc discovery. You'll still typically be on the same corporate network, which means you have the same. You should have your process that wants to talk to the service has access to a set of credentials that the other guy can access. Mm-hmm. And so what can happen there is you can actually do full-on discovery where you don't even know what binding you're going to use. So I don't know if I'm going to talk over HTTP or NetTCP over, those are the typical two that you'll be using. You don't know which one and you don't really care, because you know that you'll be using Windows Auth to talk in between the two. Or you know that if I'm able to find the service, it uses this particular username and password. And so there's some a priori knowledge that you'll usually have in these discovery scenarios that allows you to do some really clever things and really minimize your configuration, which is the cool bit.
So one thing I'm wondering, I know that you've been looking a little bit at the cloud lately, and if, to say it lightly, right? I know you've been doing a lot of that. What are some of the implications to this discussion that we're having around architectural assembly of distributed systems when I start looking at the cloud? Is it really different? I mean, we're already talking over a service boundary, so what's different?
Okay, so that's, again, really interesting. So the things that are different here depends on whose cloud stack you're looking at. And typically when you're looking at the cloud stack, realistically, folks, especially in our audience, are looking at either Amazon Web Services or they're looking at Azure. And the things that are different there are, it depends on how big your application winds up being or how big you think it's going to get, also how much concurrent access you want to have to handle. And with constrained systems where you're operating in your own data center, one of the things that a lot of these systems typically have in them is they're always up to date. No matter what I ask for data, no matter when I ask for it, I always get information that's available right now. When you're building up in the cloud, one of the things you have to watch out for, and it's something that a lot of times people will ignore on smaller systems, but the cloud's going to bring this out to you right away. And this thing called the CAP theorem that Eric Brewer wrote about a while ago. CAP theorem says you can have three things: consistency, availability, or partition tolerance. Or consistency is I have transactions so that when I save something, everybody gets it. I can have availability, which means the application's up and running, or I can have partition tolerance, which means when a network failure happens, the application is still able to function. When you're designing big distributed systems, you only get two. A lot of companies have been able to convince themselves that they can get three, but it's largely because their systems are so small that they're not having to worry about stuff. They're not having to worry, they don't have the partition tolerance. The network failures happen very often. They don't have applications crash very often. And when these things do crash, because they said that I need consistency, availability, and partition tolerance, when any one of those fail, their application drops down and is dead until they fix it. If you don't believe me, just again, look at any of your data centers. If you think you have a large application with running 100 systems, imagine running a system in the cloud that's got thousands of boxes behind it. And while you may only be using a finite number of boxes for your servers, so for example, Amazon, they limit you at 20 unless you get special dispensation like Netflix did. I think Netflix runs thousands of instances these days.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you do that, you have to remember that you've also got lots of data. And whenever you're accessing the platform-based services for storage, for databases, for caching, for cloud access, anytime you're accessing that kind of stuff, you're accessing hundreds of boxes whether you like it or not, because pretty much everything that you write is written out to three places. So it's three different boxes. And you just don't know how much your stuff is spread. So what winds up happening is as you get to these bigger systems, you have to figure out which one of these things are you going to be lenient on. So will you show stale data and go inconsistent? Will you give up application availability? Or will you allow network failures to allow your application to go down? Typically, what you're going to do is you're going to design for availability and partition tolerance, and you're going to allow data to be stale. And even then, in these systems, data is usually not that stale. If you have data that doesn't get replicated to all sources within a minute, that's pretty rare. So that's one of the things that you get when you move to the cloud, is you actually wind up seeing this stuff. And so there's been comments like folks who work on Amazon Web Services. One of the things you'll note right away is that when you look at your virtual machine, the virtual machine itself appears to have a 1 gigabit connection to the rest of the network. However, because of all the other connections going on, because of all the other, your virtual machine hosted on a box that has God knows how many machines,
right,
and maybe one of those is really busy, so you don't know how much of that 1 gigabit you're actually getting. As a result, you'll see lossy networks, you'll see connections that drop in between, and so on. The difference between the cloud and your data center is that with the cloud, you're going to have to tackle network availability sooner. If you do this in your own data center, you only have to worry about when all your boxes get fully loaded. And unfortunately, most of us are still working with data centers where our boxes, even with virtualization, are maybe approaching 50 or 60% utilization, which is still nowhere near what Amazon does. So that's what you run into when you get to the cloud.
So really, it's just refocusing on those basics that we probably should have been doing anyway.
Oh, yeah. And there's other things, too, that you get that you don't get locally. For example, if you suddenly discover... So it's the basics. Like, how do I scale out versus scale up? For a long time, we've known that scale out is much better than scale up, except for a very small constrained set of use cases. But in general, our applications, if we could pick one of those two, we should design for scale out. The cloud almost makes that part of the initial design decision as opposed to something that we add on after we've done our prototype.
Right. So that was a really good discussion at a pretty high level. I have one more thing to ask you about, and it zooms us right down into the lowest level possible, I think, when we talk about services, and that is the protocol of data exchange. There's this guy, James Clark.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And James Clark, I think about him as sort of the granddaddy of markup, I paid attention to James Clark back when I was doing SGML. Well, he came out with a statement the other day that caused a bit of a discussion on our little internal Pluralsight chat there. And it was sort of recognizing the fact that many people are looking at XML and saying, oh, your time is past, your time's done, because now we've got JSON, and that's the future of data exchange. And I'm wondering what your take is on that.
Okay, so it's kind of interesting that they were saying that. Those are the same people who also said that SOAP is never needed, And then they went out and built OAuth and OpenID on their own, and then wound up being shocked when at the OpenID workshop back in 2009, Vittorio Petrucci goes up there from Microsoft and says, "By the way, everything you guys are designing into OAuth, we did that 7 years ago with WS Security." So what you're seeing is that every time a simple technology has to be adapted for commerce, and you could add in other things too, but typically commerce is the thing that will, money will drive a lot of things. You wind up worrying about security. You wind up worrying about, is this stuff credible? Has it been hacked, and so on. And yes, they can go to a simpler format that's easier to understand, and JSON is, but eventually they're going to wind up with the same set of problems that SOAP tackled and every other enterprise thing tackles, which is, how do you make these things secure? How do I know that they haven't been modified? And how do I take something that you said to me and repeat that to somebody else, and they know that you were the original person who said it, not me? So XML tackled a lot of those problems. It didn't I agree with Clark where he said that everything.
Hold on, though. To be fair, shouldn't we say that SOAP tackled a lot of those problems?
Well, also, so for example, for non-repudiation and security, so being able to make sure that the message wasn't altered and the message wasn't signed, that wasn't a SOAP thing. That was XML digital signature for non-repudiation and XML encryption to make sure that the tokens were all, that the whole body of the message was encrypted correctly.
Okay, fair enough.
So SOAP may have been the driving force that got people to write the spec, but those two specs in particular were done against the XML info set, not against SOAP.
Okay.
So I'd say SOAP was a catalyst more than anything else.
Well, cool. I just learned something. Thanks. Okay, go ahead.
No. So it's but anyhow, so what you're going to find out is, so there, like James Clark, what he said is in the essay, if I remember correctly, was that we wound up having a bunch of things getting layered on, and they were enterprise heads who were designing the things. And with these enterprise heads, they worried about the theoretical possibilities, and I've been involved in some of these discussions. And when you get in these discussions with very, very smart people, sometimes you get into discussions, and sorry to be crass, but mine is bigger than yours. And so you try to show that I understand this scenario more deeply than you do. And so you introduce these weird edge cases that no one cares about, and then you design for them.
Right.
XML has gotten that far, where we were designing for edge cases that, frankly, if we hadn't supported them, you could have worked around them. So XML namespace is not one of those, but there was the idea of facets on XML.
Mm-hmm.
Facets, very interesting. It allows you to do validation, declare that I will only accept values in a particular range. Unfortunately, most XML processors don't support them, and as a result, nobody uses them. So, and there's just one example of, and that's from the XSD spec getting too complicated.
Well, that's a good example of why we're hearing that discussion right now that says, oh, XML is a bloated technology and we want to go lighter.
Yeah. And so what you're seeing now is you're seeing the APIs come out. Now even with JSON and that kind of stuff, what you're seeing is people are saying, I would like to see more self-documentation and more metadata languages. So I've actually seen things where people want to expand OData to add more metadata about what's going on. And I've argued back on the list and other places that, look, in reality, what people want is they want a simple markup language that makes sure that things are secure, haven't been modified. And the other thing they want is good documentation. If you give me good documentation, I don't need an XML document that documents what your Word doc says.
Do I hear you saying that they want a standards-based simple object access protocol?
Yeah, they do. that's really what you're hearing over and over again. People say, well, and the people who make these calls aren't the users of the stuff. It's the tools vendors who would like to be able to generate the general-purpose client. Whereas because those general-purpose clients could be created for all these other stacks, what we saw in a lot of worlds, so... For example, the Java world and the .NET world got on board with SOAP. And in those two areas, you can get great proxies generated for you by the WSDL documents. PHP, Ruby, and everybody else didn't care so much. And so there you see JSON, because JSON has a natural mapping to dictionaries. And so they did the easy thing. They said, for security, it's point-to-point, so we'll use SSL. And for description languages, how about documentation? And documentation's been doing a really good job. And the only people I see who don't like documentation are tools vendors who want to auto-generate these proxies for you. Just that's just my personal experience. I could be off.
Well, there's a lot of value in having that little proxy spooled up for you on the other side. A lot of systems take great advantage of that, right? Because if I'm the guy who is publishing that service, I want my consumers to be able to take advantage of it in a very, very simple way. One way you've already talked about, which is you go build an SDK and give it to them.
Yep.
But this auto-generation of proxies gotten us a long way in the world. And you know, admittedly, it's sort of like the VB script in Excel macro, but works pretty good.
Yeah. So, but the weird thing, though, is that like with that auto-generation, the amount of time that you invest into doing the auto-generation of the proxy could have been equally well spent. At the end of the day, if you have clients who are .NET and you want to support them, I could also write a .NET SDK that supports them. So that's the path Amazon took, and that's working pretty well. And it's not that it's any more efficient use of your developer's time either, because they need to produce documentation and other things that show the Java developer, how do I interact with the Amazon service? The .NET developer, the PHP and Ruby developer, how do I interact with the service? And so you're actually paying a bit of a higher price, because not only do I have the proxy, like the proxy generation isn't the hard part of that demo, it isn't the hard part of the SDK. The hard part is showing proper usage, proper error handling, and proper concepts to understand you do A before B before C. If D happens, then this is how you resolve the issue. That's the hard part. It's never the proxy. It's like they solved the simplest part of the problem.
Okay, so backing up to this original point on the thread, sounds like XML is here to stay for a while, and all the folks who are decrying its death via JSON, maybe not so much, not yet.
Oh, no, so it won't be dying, but then again, JSON has a whole bunch of other advantages that XML doesn't have. For example, I can parse JSON inside of JavaScript instantly. Parsing XML inside of JavaScript is a pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much every language out there has a JSON to object and object to JSON interpreter, because JSON's got to actually map to objects really nicely. Arrays are arrays. Name value pairs are name value pairs. So it all, you know, so if I have a property with a value, I can do that pretty easily in any language. So JSON does nail the simplicity problem very nicely. And for the, you know, with the rise of HTML5 and the rise of Apple, JavaScript is, and JSON is, you know, if I have to pick two formats, I would suggest do the JSON one, get that one done first, and then do XML if you need to.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It's and again, the reason why I say that is not is if you have both of those customers, you'll probably have far more JSON customers, and the XML customers, by and large, can consume your JSON as easily as the XML.
Okay, folks, I defy you to tell me that you didn't learn something today on this show. What a great conversation. I want to thank Scott for joining us on the show. And as always, I want to thank the Judies for letting us use their music and tell you that you can get in contact with me and the show at cast.pluralsight.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and I look forward to seeing you in class sometime soon.